I have been introduced quite recently as Canada's revenge on the United States. You know, from the land of the dew line, early warning system. But this is one of my themes tonight, as it were. The artist as early warning system for new media. But another main theme, of course, will be that the medium is the massage and not the message. And that it really works us over. It really takes hold and massages the population in a savage way, which does recall, from the land of the dew line, I can bring you a special kind of world of jokes that you may not have encountered, namely the grievance joke associated with French Canada. It's not like the Pole joke or the Italian joke and so on. I have a bit of a cold. And it feels very strange. I'm very pleased to be here, but it feels very strange to be here when I was out there a few nights ago listening to Arthur Koestler. It's a very strange switch of roles. But I think it was Steve Allen who said that the funny man is a man with a grievance. And if you look around at the joke world from that point of view, it's sometimes rather instructive. In Canada, we have jokes such as the one about the mouse being pursued by the cat and finally hiding under the floor, and all is quiet until suddenly there's a kind of a bow-wow, arf-arf sound, and the mouse figures, house dog has come, scared cat away, and up comes the mouse, the cat grabs it. As the cat chews the mouse down, it says, you know, it pays to be bilingual. And there are a lot of those jokes around up there, but I think it is rather amusing to watch the joke as a sign of grievance. And in the same way, slang can be an indicator of subtle change of sensibility, shifting patterns of perception. And if our youngsters were encouraged to pay the utmost attention and respect to slang there, from this point of view, it might clarify some of the problems they have. Isn't it strange that no matter how complicated slang is, no child ever made a mistake in slang? And that goes even for the word cool. I once present one of my children with a strange object. It was actually a yearbook from Rice University. And it was made, it was about 6 by 6 inches square, just cards taped together. And it had the little stories and poems of the year in it. And when our 13-year-old saw this, he said, "Dad, that's real cool." And he was using the term quite correctly. But many people have difficulty with that term, especially when I use it. And actually, I merely draw it from the world of slang, in which it means involved and detached at the same time, like a surgeon operating. Cool means identification with the creative process. When a person is both involved and detached, he has to identify with the creative process. You can read a great deal about the concept cool in Mr. Eliot's Four Quartets. It's a somewhat oriental concept. And the Western man tends to be either involved or detached, but not both at once. So this is a new development in our society. It is a complicated idea, and it is a profoundly creative idea. Well, I'm going to have a pleasant few minutes here, and I'm going to break at 9 o'clock so that some people can be seated. And then we'll continue and have a few questions after a bit of chatting. One of the strange changes that is taking place in our world, and John Cage gave me a curious example of what it meant to him, is that we're moving out of the world of the planter, out of the world of the specialist, out of the world of the fragmented person, into the world of the hunter, the unified person. This is the meaning of James Bond. It's the meaning of the sleuth, the meaning of the obsession with crime in our world, because the criminal or criminologist alike are both hunters They belong to the old Paleolithic world and are really a new type of human being in our midst. The person who explores the total human environment, the way the old hunter used to and food gatherer used to explore his entire environment as a unified field. Because the man, the planter, man, the basket weaver, the pot maker, and so on, he came in after the Paleolithic man, and we've had thousands of years of the planter. And John Cage, when I mentioned this to him, he said, that's very interesting. So I said, I spend my life hunting mushrooms. I am not the least bit interested in cultivating them. And this is a curious illustration of the difference between the two kinds of man. The hunter is not concerned with classification or specialism or the processes of cultivation, only with discovery. And there are some rather exciting things afoot. For example, if one wanted to talk about the future of work in our world, we know that it has very little to do with jobs as they're presently understood. It has much to do with discovery, much to do with knowing, much to do with involvement in processes, so much so that the future of work is plainly knowing. And there was a time when the job of royalty, the prince, was not to learn any special skill, but simply to grow up. Jacques Ellul, the author of Propaganda, points out that in our 20th century world, the child is the hardest working child in all human history. Our children, in a 20th century information environment, have to process more data than any human being in any previous culture of the world. Our children, from early infancy, are engaged in extraordinarily hard work. And that work is mainly just growing up. Because to grow up in a modern electronic environment is a fantastically complex and difficult job. It's also a job which threatens to deprive people of identity and, the personal concept. Because one of the peculiarities of an electronic environment is that people become so profoundly involved in each other that they lose that sense of private identity. This is one of the peculiar cruxes of our time, that people precisely become profoundly involved in one another in an all-at-once simultaneous field of happenings, and then begin to lose their sense of private identity. Because identity used to be connected with simple classification and fragmentation and non-involvement. In a world of profound involvement, identity seems to evaporate. Well, the future of work as knowing, the future of identity as involvement, brings one around to a kind of idea of perhaps roles. Instead of jobs, roles. A mother doesn't have a job, she has 60 jobs, and that's a role. A top exec doesn't have a job, he has many jobs simultaneously, that is a role. I think this is happening to all of us in varying degrees. The very speeded up world we live in guarantees that we can all have a highly integrated existence, which really points in the direction of role playing rather than of job holding. I was talking to a group of managers one time, and I thought I'd just try it out on them. It seemed to me plausible to suggest to them that the real future of old age in business is discovery. And they were quite struck by this. It seemed to make profound sense. Most of them were over 40. But the point about old age as a period of discovery contradicts the merely chronological approach to things. But the older man in business is a man who knows the field. And he's in a much better position to be a discoverer than some younger man who is merely job-holding. And so there's hope. And another, in case I forget it, there's another basic theme associated with this computer threat to job-holding. "Come into my parlor," said the computer to the specialist. Anybody who wants to be taken over by a computer, just specialize. But one of the hopeful things about the computer is this. that as a retrieval system, the instantaneous speed of retrieval by computer offers a tremendous future of discovery, because a retrieval system of very high speed brushes so many facets of knowledge together, so many kinds of layers of experience get brushed together, that they reveal structures, they reveal forms, they reveal the life of forms, they reveal knowledge in all sorts of new patterns. So it is typical of our time, or any other time perhaps, that they should tackle this new form of technology and put it on the old job, classified data. What we're doing with the computer up till now is merely giving it to the librarians and to the card catalogers. But the possibility of retrieval as a form of discovery is something we all know from our own memories. When we recall something, we tend to make discoveries. We certainly tend to make changes in the pattern of the thing we know. But Finnegan's Wake is a book built entirely on this retrieval system. And, you know, casting his perils before swains. This is a phrase out of Finnegan, and it's typical of the technique of Finnegan. Joyce regarded the human language as the biggest storage system of human knowledge and perception anywhere. And his own use of that vast store of human perception was to retrieve from it in a pattern which made discovery natural. Though he might have been more humble, there's no police like Holmes. That's retrieval. The pun, as a form of retrieval, brushes various layers and contexts together and creates a new discovery pattern. So the computer offers many advantages besides just the threat to wipe out jobs and provide leisure. Now, the future of, under electric conditions, the future of suggests perhaps an approach to various other things, which I might mention a while on that theme, the future of the planet as a work of art. Since the planet has its new environment of satellites and information, electronic information, the planet is rapidly becoming an old nose cone, a work of art. Like the Model T, like old silence on TV, the planet is now becoming a content of our own man-made environment, and the future of the planet as Williamsburg, as work of art, as a carefully prepared archaeological exhibit, is really quite amusing. And the future work of mankind will be mainly raking and tidying and clipping the whole planet, putting it in shape. Reconstructing it pretty much the way it was when the pilgrims landed and that sort of thing. I'm merely using this as an illustration of a basic theme that anything becomes a work of art as soon as it is surrounded by a new environment. Give any form at all a new environment and it acquires art status. In other words, it becomes visible, because this is the peculiar character of art. It creates attention, it creates perception. And the role of the artist as a creator of perceptual models and perceptual means is perhaps misunderstood by those who think of art as primarily a blood bank of stored human values. In our time, there are a great many unhappy people who see the great art treasures of the past being polluted by a corrupt, new, vulgar environment. It never occurs to them, perhaps their job is the penetration and exploration of these new environments, and that the mere accumulation of past human experience in blood banks, called art, does not really contribute very much toward the perception of our current environment. But we might come back to that theme during questions. But a great many people are confused and unhappy at the present time because they sense that all the great values of the past are being polluted and corrupted, anemicized by a vulgar entertainment, mass entertainment. So in that regard, let's pause a moment on the future of the book. The printed book created what we call the public. With the coming of electric circuitry, you have what is called the mass. It's a time factor. The book created the public because the book was, as a printed form, made possible a very large body of people, but not simultaneous. The peculiar dimension of the mass audience is that it's all at once. It's a happening. Like telegraph, like the daily paper. The daily paper is a good example of a happening because everything that's in it happens at the same moment. The dateline is the only organizing principle in a newspaper. There is no connection between the items otherwise than the dateline. And if you take away the dateline from any newspaper, whatever, you have a quite handsome surrealist poem. It becomes much more enjoyable if you pull the dateline off. The dateline presents a plausible pretext of rationality, meaning, connection, which is not really deeply related to the newspaper. The sort of constellation of events that is incorporated on any page of a newspaper is a kind of environmental image for which many people find the natural to identify empathically and so on. And the paper as a happening is very much in this dimension of the all at once. The editorial page, by contrast, represents a point of view, a fixed, arrested position with regard to the happening. And so the newspaper, in regard to this, the editorial is very closely related to the book as a form. The book, the printed book, rather, as a form, created the public, and Montaigne said, upon recognizing the existence of this new entity, this new environment called the public, he said, I owe the La Publique a complete portrait of myself. It was a matter of immediate response on the part of writers that their task as writers would be from now on the etiolation, the evolving of self-portrait, an image. There was no such impulse or response in the Middle Ages when they had the scribe and manuscript culture, or in the ancient world. It was with the coming of the printed book that people suddenly felt the need to reflect, to bounce their image off this public as a form of self-expression, self-portraiture. Self-portraiture was a very special response to the printed word and was never felt as a need or a response for the manuscript form of culture. Now, Xerox has brought a kind of revolution into the publishing world that is only being felt slowly. It will be felt more and more. Xerox is the application of electric circuitry to a world which had formerly been merely mechanical and fragmented. Xerox enables, or xerography enables, the reader to become publisher. And this is an important aspect of all electric circuitry. The audience is increasingly involved in the process. With the public, the audience was detached, observant, but not involved. With circuitry, the reader, the audience, becomes involved in itself and in the process of publishing. The book, the future of the book, is very much in the order of book as information service. Instead of the book as a fixed package of repeatable and uniform character suited to the market with pricing and so on, the book is increasingly taking on the character of service, an information service. And the book as an information service is tailor-made and custom-built. The strange dynamic or pattern of electric information is to involve the audience as increasingly as part of the workforce, instead of just tossing things to it as consumer or as entertainment. the tendency is to involve the audience's workforce, as with electric toasters, electric razors, electric anything. You do the work. And we're coming to this, I'll come back to this perhaps, apropos the future of television or forms like that, in which it will become possible, or is now possible, to brief audiences in prime time on top-level problems in physics, science, whatever, and invite their response to these problems by IBM cards sent out in supermarkets or in magazines. And you see, if Robert Oppenheimer is fond of saying there are kids playing right here on the sidewalk who could solve some of my toughest problems in physics, they have modes of perception that I lost 40 years ago. Now, Oppenheimer realizes in that remark that most scientific problems are really not concept problems, but percept problems. That most scientists are blocked in their perceptions by preconceptions and prepossessions. When you're dealing simultaneously with several million people, it's obvious that somebody in that audience is going to have a perceptual perforation into the problem without any difficulty whatever. Eight scientists working on a problem for 50 years might not get through, but 10 million people working on the problem for 10 minutes might get through. And anyway, audience participation can mean many things. You remember in the old quiz shows, the audience was browned off when they discovered that the shows had been rigged and they'd really been left out. There was nothing dishonest about rigging quiz shows any more than there is about rigging a movie. And making it look different from what a real-life situation might. But it was a misuse of the medium of TV, which calls for much participation. The movie world doesn't call for any participation. It's a fantasy world, highly visual, with the audience sitting very much back from the show. TV is not like that. TV is a profoundly involving medium, with the audience as environment, the audience as vanishing point, the audience as screen. In the movie, the audience is the camera eye. The audience looks out at the environment. With TV, the audience is the environment, is the screen, is the vanishing point. And this creates a completely different relation to programming. It creates a kind of oriental effect with reverse perspective. Audience as vanishing point creates a reverse perspective with kind of orientalism involved. It's not, I think, accidental that our Western world is taking on many profound oriental traits since television, but it's not just television, it's electric circuitry. The safety car is another peculiar example of electric circuitry afflicting a mechanical object. That is, the consequences of the car are now being felt by the designers of the car, whereas formerly they merely concerned themselves with the projectile. You hurled it out into the public and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. But suddenly in the age of circuitry, the feedback is coming into the design. Product design now takes on the character of audience participation. But perhaps the safety car is more an example of the effect of the space capsule. Bucky Fuller is famous for having pointed out, among many brilliant observations, that the space capsule is the first man-made environment, totally man-made. You know the old saying, you can't take it with you. In the space capsule, you've got to take it with you. You have to take the planet with you. And so the space capsule is really a kind of complete environment in which all consequences of all maneuvers are anticipated by design, by the built-in design pattern. This sense of the space capsule as applied to the motor car is now creating the motor car as a padded cell. And what more appropriate form of design for the maniac driver? But the motor car as a feedback design pattern turns into a padded cell. I have a friend who speaks of the motor car as the carsophagus. And don't rock the bandwagon is another of his remarks. The carsophagus is a form of peripatetic vehicle in which the effects of the object on the environment are built back into the object. And this is something that is characteristic of electric circuits. A circuit as such is a form that feeds back and feeds us into the circuit. All circuits are do-it-yourself objects. The book on Xerox becomes somewhat like the safety car. The reader becomes a publisher and author. In the ancient days of the scribe, in manuscript cultures, the scribe was both publisher and author. And we are sort of coming around, circling around to that condition again, in which with Xerox, the reader of the book can excerpt it and relate it to any other excerpts or any other notions or any other soundtracks and publish it as his own creative effort. And this is already happening. The teachers are strongly inclined to make their own books for their own classes, designed specifically for the needs of a particular class. This is another peculiar feature of electric technology. It tends toward decentralized, tailor-made, custom-built servicing. You see, it's typical of our rear-view mirror orientation that we look at all these new technologies as if they were reflexes of the old technology. For heaven knows how long, people have encountered each new technology by translating it back into the old familiar one. It's not, all the types of examples of that. The first motor cars were made with buggy whip holders, and the new automation computer devices are being made as if they were card catalogs. And this strange habit of looking backward when moving forward is one that perhaps won't quite bear up, isn't quite consistent with jet speeds and electronic speeds. It may be that we are the first human generation to feel the need for a close look at what's actually happening under our noses instead of that rearview mirror look. Because the rearview mirror is a very comforting spot. It gives you a sense of remoteness and like bonanza. The suburban world of our time lives in bonanza land. This gives it a comfortable sense of distance and security. It's a 19th century image. When the railway was new in the 19th century, people formed an image not of the railway and the new world it was creating, the new cities. They formed an image of an Arcadian retreat, a pastoral, innocent world, a Jeffersonian paradise, that was their image of the railway. As soon as they banged into the railway, they translated themselves back into an agrarian, Arcadian, pastoral world. And this is a kind of normal human reaction to novelty and innovation. Inappropriateness as a reaction is in no way deters people from this strategy. It's a kind of deja vu. Every time you encounter the new, you say, I've been here before. And this isn't as new as you might think, all that. This seems to tie in with the ancient theory of human learning as needfully going from the known to the unknown. I don't think there's too much evidence that this is a basic pattern of human learning. I think there's lots of evidence, though, for the fact that the moment you encounter the unknown, you translate it back into the known. This means that we never encounter the unknown. We encounter only convenient self-deception. But the world of electric technology and circuitry, then, as involving the audience as workforce, has extraordinary implications, and you can see while this development is taking place, while the audience is becoming profoundly involved in making a world of entertainment, the gloom borers stand around classifying the program and providing program ratings of the most unhappy kind. this, while the audience is about to take over this vast creative act, the gloom pourers stand around reading off audience ratings. For example, 350 million people each week watch Bonanza in 62 different countries of the world. What could be a more gloomy image of the human condition? And so on. Actually, Bonanza isn't that bad a show. There was a little boy in Nairobi a few weeks ago in Africa who was found wandering around the city, and on being questioned by the police, he explained he had come from some village, and he was an orphan. And they said, yeah, well, why are you here? He said, I'm looking for Mr. Cartwright. I think he can help me. And I'm quite sure he could, too. But Bonanza is for countries in Africa or in Indonesia and China. Bonanza must have a very strange aspect. It must look like some distant science fiction image of some remote world to come. That is, for countries that never had a 19th century, Bonanza and by the way, this also happens to apply to the West Coast. California didn't have a 19th century. During the 19th century, people were making their way out there as best they could. But there were no factories, there were no cities, there was no industrial life, etc., etc. Now, a note, the result is that not having had a 19th century, the West Coast leapfrogged out of the 18th into the 20th with great advantage to itself. That is, if you leapfrog out of one century and leapfrog over a century or two, you can, upon encountering the new conditions, you can feel completely uncrippled by the older ones. You can behave in a much more spontaneous and much more resourceful way than people who had been through the whole process. Those who lived through the 19th century lived through the most stupefying and fragmenting and systematizing and categorizing century in human history. Therefore, anybody who can leapfrog over the 19th century might retain some imaginative life. And those who went through the 19th century were maimed and mutilated very horribly because of this enormous power to fragment and systematize and classify everything that happens. So, Canada is in a peculiar position, by the way. Canada never had anything, as it were, but a 19th century. That is, Canada was invented in the 19th century. And the United States was invented in the 18th century. Wasn't it Adlai Stevenson who said Columbus went too far? This business of leapfrogging, though, is not without its significant features. In our present time, you see, there are many countries in the world who are leapfrogging out of 10,000 B.C. into the 20th century. Many countries that are doing this, leapfrogging out of prehistory into post-history. And just psychically, what is the consequence of skipping thousands and thousands of years of Western history? No one knows. It hasn't been thought about. And so, to come back a moment to the strange prodigy of the zero-graphed book, the tendency to involve audience as actor, as publisher, as writer is a characteristic that applies to an enormous amount of electric technology, quite apart from this particular instance. And the it's a sort of prospect that will increasingly bring us into the need for new instruments of handling our problems. One way of putting it is to say, for the first time in human history, there is more information and data outside the, say, the classroom or the school situation than inside. The amount, a sheer amount of levels of information outside in the environment far exceed the amount of data and information inside the classroom. Now, this is not just of very recent origin. It's occurring more and more rapidly and on a much bigger and bigger scale. You know, all the statistics one hears, again, intended to panic people, that by the year 1980, there will be more people, more scientists than people, and more and more. But what would seem to be, therefore, the future of education in a world in which the proportions of information have been reversed? That in the ordinary human past, there had been more in knowledge and information available inside the classroom conditions than outside. Well, with this spectacular reversal of this condition, it would seem to be possible that the business of the school has also reversed, that the business of the school is no longer instruction, but discovery. And that the business of the teaching establishment is to train perception upon the outer environment instead of merely stenciling information upon the brain pans of children inside the environment. Now, we have never had an educational system programmed to train perception of the outer world, and it will create a considerable trauma or shock to switch into that mode of activity. But it's like the audience in the entertainment world that is ready to go into action on high-level problems. The children in our school system at the present time have very high-level information resources, both in their own makeup and nervous systems and in the world immediately accessible to them. And they can given the task in teams off researching all sorts of fascinating problems. For example, suppose a group of elementary school children were given the job of trying to find out what was happening to America since color TV. Teams of them could be turned loose in just making inventories of effects observable in clothing, in food, in cars, in designs, in family life, in all sorts of forms. If they merely made inventories, they didn't have to use any ideas, they didn't have to reach any conclusions, they merely were invited to observe, to make inventories of effects. Small children love this kind of work and are just as able researchers as any team of sociologists in the world. And the accumulation of such inventories can be absolutely necessary and indispensable to the highest operations. And many people, I was hearing a sociologist today suggest that it was quite impossible to make a direct connection between television and any change whatever. Now this is in a certain sense true. On the other hand, if you make an inventory of all the changes that have taken place in the last 12, 15 years since TV, without any preconceptions, without any theories about what television is or what television does, if one merely made an inventory of all the changes in speech, in politics, in habits of human association, habits of reading, habits of dress and food, and so on, it might become quite evident that there had been a kind of a pattern of change. And this would be a scientific report in the usual way of an induction. No conclusions, just here are the changes that have taken place in the past 15 years in all these fields since TV. And you could, in turn, look at that same curve in relation to some other technology, if you chose. But the way to study the effects, well, for example, if you wanted to study what the motor car was, you might find out more from what it did to the environment and the community. In other words, if you notice that the motor car created road systems and vast servicing industries, You would probably have a better idea of the motor car than you could have from photographic images of cars in catalogs. The car is what it does to people and what it does to the environment. And so, with any other medium, as far as I know, a medium creates an environment. An environment is a process. An environment is a process. It is not a wrapper. It's an action. And it goes to work on our nervous systems and on our sensory lives, completely altering them. Content of any technology is nearly inevitably the older technology. The new environment goes around the old environment and turns the old one into an art form. This happened to the Greeks, it happened to the Romans, it happened to the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and so on. There's no lack of evidence of this happening. Now, at the present time, I mentioned the strange fate of the planet as art form resulting from the new environment of satellite and electronic information. Well, now, one of the biggest revolutions in Western culture occurred when the world of the arts in the 18th century began to create deliberately to create landscapes and environments as a way of controlling mental life. The 18th century artist, whether in paint or in poetry, or in landscaping and city building, the 18th century artist created landscapes, what he called the picturesque, making things look as if they already were framed in pictures. And he found that these landscapes or picturesque situations could be used as a means of controlling the mental life of the observer. And the function of romantic art or picturesque art was to control moods. It was all oriented toward effect. Earlier, the arts had been more concerned with simply permitting the audience to enjoy the sense of community and festive involvement. Medieval arts, as we are popularly aware, medieval arts were festive and communal and participative. They were not intended to give any sense of privileged or elite life. Now, it's a little bit like the Balinese who say, we have no art, we do everything as well as possible. They think of art as that which applies to the environment. They programmed the environment. Art for them means dealing with the environment itself as if it were a work of art. And this, I think, is one of the meanings of pop art. Pop art is a recognition that the outer environment is itself capable of being processed like art. And this, I think, is an electronic phenomenon that only in an age of electronic immediacy and totality could we ever dream of tackling the whole human environment as a work of art. This is happening to us, and pop art is merely a report to the nation, as it were, that this event is taking place and that we can prepare ourselves accordingly. You know how the elite artist, blood bank people, are shocked by pop art because they try to classify the content of pop art. Instead of viewing pop art as a means of perception, they think of it as a means of classification. As merely a means of ratings. The idea that it might have a function just training human perception doesn't seem to get through easily to these people. But let's go back for a moment to the 18th century landscape picturesque artist. Having devised this landscape as a way of controlling the mental life of populations, there came shortly after, in the middle of the 19th century, a sudden break in which the artist said, it is the inner life, not the outer landscape, that counts. And the symbolists, the Rambos, the Wagners, the Baudelaires, began to examine the inner mental landscape as something that could be programmed as a means of enriching consciousness, of creating an inclusive consciousness, instead of just creating, as the Romantic artists had done, creating a mood, they began to work on the idea of the total consciousness.
That's McLuhan, 1966, at the Museum of Modern Art. Now, it didn't really become famous till 67 and 68. And a lot of what he says in this lecture is in his books of 1967 and 68. So it's really funny to hear him say these very interesting patterns that he's presenting as serious stuff, being regarded as jokes, and the audience laughing their heads off at this because no one had ever heard what McLuhan was saying. His previous books were more prose and not so conversational, and what he was saying in this lecture had not been developed yet or uttered. So that's what's funny.